and he continues to be excited about the work that the NAACP is going. I made that story a lot longer than it needed to be to show you that I could have just said, This is racist, this is anti-black, and we're not having it. We don't want to be a part of it. We shouldn't have this conversation. But here's what happened when I had the same conversation. So after the conversation with the Chinese American Citizen Alliance, I emailed Joseph Lyons and said, have you heard about this rally?
Joseph Santos Lyons is APANO's executive director. After Hardesty contacted him, he led his organization to write a series of open letters in support of Black Lives Matter.
We took time to discuss internally within the organization about signing on to some public statements of support for Akai Gurley and really recognized the need for us to use this political moment to stand publicly and visibly out on the issue.
But the protests still went on in Portland.
I have no doubt that the Chinese American protests that happened downtown at Pioneer Square, despite some of the best intentions to build connections with the Black community, did create more division for us. And it portrayed, I think, the Asian American community largely as in opposition, maybe, to the interests of Black lives. I mean, frankly, I think those tensions between all of our communities a lot of the time, and I think communities of color in general are pitted against each other in part to distract from the systems of oppression, the way whiteness and white supremacy and the way systems are designed to benefit white people at the expense of people of color really necessitates communities of color not getting along.
For Joanne Hardesty, the work of negotiating racial divides continues, especially in a city like Portland, where, according to the 2015 census, it's more than 87% white.
There will always be misunderstandings and miscues, and the best we can hope for is that people will ask forgiveness and then be open to hear how that misperception harmed the person that heard it, right, on both sides. So whether it's the Asian Pacific Islander community or the Black community, when I'm struggling to hear someone, my fallback is to ask questions because I don't want to assume. I don't want to jump in and think that I know exactly what it was you were trying to say, right? So my fallback is always to ask questions for clarification. And then if it's a really, really hard conversation, it's okay to say, well, let's come back to that. Let me think on that and let's come back and continue this conversation, right? So it doesn't have to, a uncomfortable conversation doesn't have to be a disagreeable conversation. It can be one where it happens in stages as people build comfort, as people build support, then you can move to the hard place. But I say this always, change only comes in the uncomfortable spaces, and so you have to be willing to be uncomfortable to learn and to move forward.
That was Joanne Hardesty, president of the Portland chapter of the NAACP. This is Relations, a documentary special for the Crossing East Archive Project. Check out more at crossingeast.org. I'm Dime Roberts. We're hearing sounds from a Black Lives Matter action during Martin Luther King Jr. Day on January 18, 2016, when demonstrators blocked traffic on the San Francisco Bay Bridge.
It's hard to talk about the early days of the Black Lives Matter movement, because when I say BLM, I'm talking about the Black Liberation Movement. And that's been around for a very long time.
Malkia Amala Searle is the co-founder and executive director for the Center for Media Justice, which works towards digital literacy. She also co-founded the Media Action Grassroots Network. Searle says she's been part of the Black Lives Matter network since before it was Black Lives Matter.
Black Lives Matter, the work that happened in the uprising in Ferguson, on the uprisings that have happened in Baltimore, Chicago, and all over this country, the birth of the Black Lives Matter network, all of these things are part of a long lineage, you know, of Black resistance and fighting for liberation. So what I'll say is this. In 2012, you know, when Trayvon Martin was killed and George Zimmerman was acquitted for his murder, Black Lives Matter formed a national network. But before that, Michael Brown had been killed. And the people of Ferguson rose up in response to that killing. The fact is that you can look back to Watts, and you can look back to every Black urban rebellion across the history of this nation, and they've all been in response to the murder of a young Black person.
Searle became an activist when she was a child. Her father was a member of the Black Liberation Army, but it was her mom who was her major influence. A prominent leader in the Black Panther Party, Searle's mom was the editor of their newspaper and coordinated the Black Panther Breakfast Program in Brooklyn and Harlem. Searle says there were always tensions between the Black and Asian communities then, but she remembers fondly a civil rights activist visiting her mom. Searle called her Auntie Yuri Kochiyama.
And I would spend, you know, many evenings in her Harlem apartment, which was just full to the brim of paper. I never seen nobody house with that much paper before. But she just had newspapers and all kind of papers in her house. And, you know, we would sit there under the table listening to their meetings and along with the other kids.
In an oral history interview by Densho Digital Archive, Yuri Kochiyama remembered her time in Harlem and the impact Black liberation had on her activism.
Well, I think the Black liberation movement had an influence on every movement because they were really more advanced. And I think all the other movements sort of followed suit, knowing what racism has done to this country and this feeling of white superiority that has spread all over the world. But I think the Asian movements were good because they wanted to have some connection with Puerto Ricans and Blacks.
Yuri was brilliant. She was passionate. She would cuss you out and she would hug you up. She was extremely passionate. She loved her people, and her people were so many different kinds of people. Her people was the left, and she had a particular commitment to Black lives, I think in part because she understood very deeply, in a way very few others do, that a model minority framework or stereotype is built on the back of a criminal minority stereotype. The two stereotypes can only exist in relationship to one another. And she understood that, I think, very early, before the interrogation of the model minority concept became something that was happening on a regular basis. I felt like she was doing that. And so I didn't find her to be like hugely like an academic, but she was deeply brilliant, full-bodied brilliant, and she understood these ideas, I think, before many other people did.
The kind of understanding Kochiyama displayed is something that activists of her generation worked toward. And just as the Black Liberation Movement had no centralized network, Searle says the Black Lives Matter network doesn't rely on one leader. She says it has a decentralized leadership style where everyone works to listen to each other. It's a network that was largely founded by women, many of them queer. And she says Black Lives Matter is an international movement.
We got chapters in Canada. We got chapters in the UK. There are chapters throughout Africa. There are chapters in Brazil. I mean, there are chapters all over the world. And I think that it's important to note that, right? Internationalism is one thing as an ideology, but actually having an international movement where Black Lives Matter is the chant, you know, on the streets in London, and the Black Lives Matter Network, you know, has chapters across this country. It's unique in part because it carries the legacy of the Black Panther Party forward. The Black Lives Matter Network speaks for and is of those who are pushed to the margins of even Black movements, right? So queer folks, trans folks, women, children, you know, those who are poor, those who are in prison. You know, this is not about a narrow cultural nationalism.
Cyril says in the Bay Area, Asians for Black Lives has become an important ally to the Black Lives Matter members. These Asian American activists, along with other allies, have demonstrated what solidarity looks like when Black Lives Matter activists participated in direct actions like shutting down the public transit system in the Bay Area.
Asians for Black Lives was an incredible solidarity team for these individuals that have put their freedom on the line. Because obviously, once you've taken that kind of civil disobedience, it'd be difficult to do more after that, especially because now you're in court, right? And you're on trial for the crime, or for what the court is calling a crime. And it was because we had the solidarity of Asians for Black Lives, also Bay Rising, which was at the time largely white folks, you know, who were standing in to offer solidarity, and others who were able to really stand up and be a front line for those folks that have put themselves on the line.
Malkia Cyril thinks the solidarity of activists in the Bay Area are part of a global effort to fight back against the ravages of global capitalism, which started as colonialism and the slave trade. Cyril says we are all connected.
My life depends upon the lives of, you know, children in Vietnam and in Thailand. Like, the fact of the matter is, right now, for example, every cell phone you use, you know, somebody somewhere in some other country put that thing together, you know, and when it is gone, and most likely that person was in Asia, and when that cell phone gets destroyed, That e-waste is going to somewhere in Africa. The point is that everything we touch, right? We're in a global economy, but we're just in a global society. Everything we touch touches somebody else. And so you can't win your liberation by yourself. It's not possible. You need all of those people who are affected by those systems to stand up together. And the only way you get that is if you stand down for a minute and listen. Listen to what people's experiences have been. Listen to them in their own words, in their own languages. Recognize that colonialism, especially in America, is very different than how it is every place else in the world.
Malkia Cyril, part of the Bay Area Black Lives Matter Network. I'm Dimae Roberts, Crossing East Relations, a documentary for Meteorite's Crossing East Archive Project. We looked at historic tensions and cooperation in the Asian and Black communities. How are younger activists in both communities standing up for each other?
Asians for Black Lives was formed right after the non-indictment of Eric Garner's murderer.
Ellen Choi works as a member of the Movement Generation Justice and Ecology Project.
And at that time, the Black Lives Matter movement had really bloomed across the country, and we saw that we were in a political moment. And so me and some of my Asian comrades, friends, got together because we wanted to see, we really wanted to start with dialogue. Where are we positioned as Asian community organizers and activists here in the Bay Area?
Choi is also a member of Asians for Black Lives in the Bay Area. That group is also decentralized. It was formed right after local Asian Americans had discussions about the non-indictment of police officers involved in the death of Eric Garner. She says the group needed to heed a call from Black Lives Matter activists for allies to step up and support their movement.
OPD! How you spell murder?
OPD!
How you spell murder?
OPD!
How you spell murder?
OPD!
The first direct action Asians for Black Lives took was at the Oakland Police Department.
And our job there was to shut down the Oakland Police Department in protest and also to hold space for the Black organizers who came and held their own space, chanted, were at the forefront of the media images and leading the action. Our role was to put our bodies on the line in some of the more riskier areas physically and emotionally. So we were the ones who actually shut down, locked ourselves to the doors at the Oakland Police Department while the Black organizations were able to hold their own space, but they were not in a position to be arrested or put at risk like we were. There have been other types of actions where Black folks are locking down alongside us, or they've decided that they want it to be an all-Black action, and so they're the only ones taking the risk, and we're doing other kind of behind-the-scenes support. I think the key part is, one, is just taking Black leadership and understanding what it means to center the Black leadership and working alongside them.
Ellen Choi says her experience growing up in Los Angeles and living through what happened after the Rodney King beating and police acquittal shaped her beliefs. Beliefs that it isn't just the responsibility or the obligation of African Americans to defend their communities and their lives. Choi says Asian Americans can benefit from the liberation of Black people, despite the myth of Asians as the model minority.
We both have a stake in this fight, where we understand that if Black folks, you know, every inch of Black liberation that we were able to win will benefit and impact our communities and our own liberation. But at the same time, we are also positioned in the United States to be in a position of power and have some leverage in our privilege as being uplifted as the model minority historically. And that myth, you know, that really destructive myth that the U.S. empire has really upheld has put us in a position of power in this country in relationship to Black folks. And because of that, we also have more leverage, more access to those systems of power, and also more of a responsibility to step up. So I think we're trying to hold the balance of both of those sides of our identities in relationship to this movement. And so because of that, we also feel it's really important to put our bodies on the line alongside of Black folks.
Ellen Choi says Asians for Black Lives also works to counter anti-Blackness by Asian folks. Anti-Blackness is a term used by younger generations of activists to address prejudice against African Americans, especially by other marginalized groups. At one event, Asians for Black Lives held an action at the Chinese New Year celebration and passed out red envelopes with names of Asian and Black activists who have worked together.
So there was one of them highlighted the relationship between Yuri Kochiyama and Malcolm X, Grace Lee Boggs and Jimmie Lee Boggs was another one, Thich Nhat Hanh and Martin Luther King, I think, was the other. So we went out with this information to pass out the red envelopes, but also every time a red envelope was passed out, we started a conversation. So it was kind of an organizing tactic.
Choi says the tactic was to respectfully call attention to Black lives.
We had Black Lives Matter written in Chinese. And then we also ended up projecting that on some of the floats coming by. It was pretty fun. But the idea was to kind of disrupt in a more narrative way and to include a message that while our, you know, we didn't want to disrupt in a way that was disrespectful to the actual event. And so for us, it was like, you know, it's Lunar New Year is a time for our communities to celebrate, but let's also remember there are Black families across the country who are mourning the death of their daughter or their son. And so we, you know, that's kind of what held us up to have this action together.
During the inauguration of the 45th president, Choi says Asians for Black Lives decided to be agents for Black Lives. So they tried a new form of action the week of Martin Luther King Jr. Day.
What we decided as Agents for Black Lives is that we would actually try a new form of action this year, that it wasn't going to be about, again, like shutting down any building or going to a place of power. But what we were going to do is actually help and support an action that was already brewing, led by a group called Feed the People, that was actually a very visionary action. So what we ended up doing was reclaiming public land in West Oakland at a park that was historically neglected by the city. The city hadn't been actually servicing the park except for trash collection. And we reclaimed that park and started to build what we called the village. And the residents ended up lovingly renaming it the Promised Land. But the idea was that we would actually literally build homes for houseless folks, reclaim space, and build a village of community, a village of support, a village where houseless folks can come, get services, get food, and be heard.
To listen, to be heard, and to take action for positive change. Ellen Choi says that action drew attention to the housing crisis during the Martin Luther King Jr. Day celebrations. Ellen Choi continues to work as an activist with Asians for Black Lives in Oakland, California. I'm Dime Roberts. We're listening to David Ornette Cherry, a musician and composer in Portland, Oregon. Hear his music at davidornettecherry.com. I grew up in Oregon, a state with a strong history of exclusionary laws against people of color. I was always used to being one of the few, if not only, Asian Americans in the room wherever I went. There are some rural communities that are majority Latino. And at times, like during World War II, there was a vibrant African-American community working in Vanport, outside of Portland, for the Kaiser Shipyards, until the 1948 flood decimated the town. Living in Oregon now presents people of color an even greater challenge than more diverse states. According to the U.S. Census, Oregon has gone from 83% white in 2010 to 87% in 2015. That's largely due to increased white migration and perhaps to people of color moving away. In a recent interview by the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, Scott Nakagawa said, "People often say they move to Oregon because it's safe." He said safe appeared to be a code word for white. And Nakagawa said rural Oregon is under siege by paramilitary white nationalist groups. People in Oregon, especially people of color, are gathering more and more in workshops and discussion groups to unpack their thoughts and perspectives on social issues of the day, especially about race and identity. I attended one conversation about the model minority myth hosted by Apano's Kara Carmosino. Dorian Smith came to a workshop at the Asian and Pacific Cultural Center at Oregon State University. Smith is an African-American grad student who moved to Corvallis, Oregon.
I've had discrimination from a lot of people, but I think that's just part of being an American.
Originally from Los Angeles, Smith says he was surprised by the level of anti-blackness he's encountered from people who just never interacted with African-Americans before.
You know, I'm a 31-year-old, so I don't feel too old, but just in our culture and in our music, I just get called the N-word a lot by people that aren't black, and it's such a interesting topic. So to hear that from some friends of mine that are Asian American and that might be listening to something and think it's cool to say that around me and doesn't exactly know how that affects me is something that I've had to deal with and had to have some serious conversations with and got into some heated conversations, almost some physical some physical things. So being a person of color here, especially a black person here, especially a large black person here, but it's something that you deal with, and that's kind of, that's the story of being a black man. You have to navigate that wherever you go.
So it's a lot of fear associated with African Americans.
At another workshop at Apano's Rolling Tides convention, Jay Singh talked about anti-blackness with his family members.
There was one incident where my uncle was stabbed. He worked at a store, and so that sort of left an impact and impression on my family. And so it was that stereotype of African Americans of being, you know, violent and just scary in general, that sort of perpetuated in my family, and we had to do a lot more unlearning compared to other families.
Singh says talking consistently about Black and API solidarity is crucial.
I mean, individual conversations are very critical when we're at the dinner table, when we're at, you know, prayer services or whatever. I think that sort of, it starts there with our own families, folks that we see every day or regularly that we love. I feel like that's where we have the most impact. And it can be difficult because those relationships can be fragile. And so it's hard for me. I have to admit, it's really hard to have those conversations with close folks that I've known for a long time. And I know that, and because it can break real easily if we get there. So, but I think we have to be brave and commit to those conversations to sort of demolish this anti-blackness.
Younger generations of APIs fully embrace the idea of African-American and API unity. Lexa Machinsky, a biracial Filipina student at Wilson High School, also attended Apano's convention.
I think with what I'm seeing with students and younger generations, like how we are trying to fix it, I think raising awareness on them, because we as a community have gone through injustices. Many of them never intersect with the Black community because sometimes there are just things that we have never had to overcome. But at the same time, we do have the empathy. And so I think that we just have to find the capacity to be aware of it. And we have to find ways to share it with each other. I do think that just being there as a support is something that we can definitely do. And I don't see enough of it.
Machinsky says young APIs are trying to find solutions collectively.
I have an immense amount of hope that in the future, everything will get better. It's probably going to be like much harder to overcome some things. But I do believe that all the communities, all the minorities have the capability to get together and just fight it one at a time, baby steps. But yes, I do believe immensely. And I think that there's great hope for it.
While it's important for individuals to change their own beliefs, it takes all communities to create systemic changes regarding anti-blackness in America. Throughout our history, Asians and Blacks have often been pitted against each other to benefit white supremacy. There have been times when Black and Asian communities have worked together to achieve civil rights. As Lexa Machinsky said, it's baby steps. Perhaps that's what we're all still undergoing, those baby steps, when it comes to African American and Asian American solidarity. Crossing East Relations was produced by Dime Roberts, executive producer of Media Rights, and was made possible by the Oregon Cultural Trust, the Oregon Arts Commission, and the Regional Arts and Culture Council. Associate producers were Robin Takayama and Alan Montesilio, with collaborative support from Kara Carmesino of the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon and their Model Minority Workshops. We had script consultation from Catherine Stifter. Our engineer was Clark Salisbury. Audio recordings of marches provided by M. Lin, community organizer at API Equality, Northern California. You've been listening to music by Portland musician and composer David Arnett Cherry. Hear more of his music at davidarnettcherry.com. For more info on this program, the Crossing East series, and the Crossing East Archive, visit crossingeast.org or mediarights.org. This is a Media Rights production. I'm Dime Roberts.
Did you know that KBOO podcasts all our news and talk shows?
You can find the podcast on KBOO's website, kboo.fm, on Google Play, iTunes, and Stitcher.
Just search for your favorite show and hit subscribe to get all the latest episodes downloaded to your favorite device.
Or search for KBOO on iTunes, Google Play to get all the KBOO podcasts.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present David Barsamian, Resistance in the Age of Trump, on Sunday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Journalist, author, and activist David Barsamian will be speaking about the broad coalition in opposition to the Trump administration, which includes activists from a range of causes, progressive Democrats, and concerned Republicans. He'll be reflecting on the core issues at stake today and why so many people from such a range of identities and perspectives are challenging the administration. Again, that's KBOO Presents David Barsamian, Resistance in the Age of Trump, on Sunday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland.
Tenemos miedo porque no tenemos miedo.